This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We will continue to keep an eye on Las Vegas and bring you any major developments, but for now, let's shift gears to the Supreme Court. Its new term begins this week with a wide range of contentious issues. The court will hear arguments on gerrymandering, anti-discrimination laws, First Amendment rights, government access to your cell phone, and possibly on President Trump's travel ban. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg may have said it best last month when she addressed law students at Georgetown Law Center.
There's only one prediction that's entirely safe about the upcoming term, and that is it will be momentous.
It's also the first full term for its newest justice, Neil Gorsuch. Coming up, we'll explore what's on the docket, what's at stake, and what is going on inside the high court these days. Joining us in studio is Elizabeth Wydra, president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a public interest law firm and think tank based here in Washington. Elizabeth, welcome to 1A.
Good to be with you, Jonathan. Joshua.
Also with us is Kareem Creighton, a visiting professor at Vanderbilt Law School and managing partner of Crim Card Consulting Services. Professor Creighton, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be with you.
William Jay is a partner and co-chair of Goodwin Law Firm's appellate litigation practice. He's a former assistant to the Solicitor General and a former law clerk to the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. He has argued 15 cases before the Supreme Court. William Jay, glad to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us from WUOT Public Radio at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, Josh Blackman, a constitutional law professor at the South Texas College of Law in Houston. He's an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute and the author of Unraveled: Obamacare, Religious Liberty, and Executive Power. Professor Blackman, glad to have you with us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me back.
We also welcome your questions and thoughts about the Supreme Court and which cases may be important to you. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@wamu.org. There's so much to talk about, Elizabeth. I almost don't know where to begin, but clearly this seems to be a very different year than last year, where a lot of what's happening before the court seems like it could be very, very consequential. Neil Gorsuch clearly comes down ideologically in line with who he kind of considered his ideological mentor, the late Antonin Scalia. I wonder how you're seeing the party line division, the left-right legal division of the Supreme Court going forward, and how much that will play into the docket overall, from your view.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Justice Ginsburg got it right. This is definitely going to be a momentous term, and not just because of the important cases that the court is already scheduled to hear, and they're only halfway through about filling up their docket, but also because, as you mentioned, this is the first full complete term for Justice Gorsuch, and that really changes the dynamics on the court. We have a pretty evenly ideologically split court, and so obviously, it would have made a huge difference if President Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland, replaced Justice Scalia after he passed. That, of course, didn't happen because the Senate Republicans blocked his nomination. So instead, the fact that we have Justice Gorsuch really does reinforce the conservative majority on the Supreme Court. Of course, again, all eyes will be on Justice Anthony Kennedy, who is the one who kind of straddles the ideological divide. While he mostly votes with conservatives, he does vote in key cases, particularly we can think of cases involving abortion, obviously the same-sex marriage case from 2015 that ensured a national constitutional right to marriage equality. He votes with liberals in some of those important cases. So all eyes will be on Justice Kennedy as the deciding vote, but I think court watchers will also be looking closely at Justice Gorsuch to see how he does in his first full term on the bench.
Yeah, William Jay, I was going to ask you about that since you have had a chance to work very closely with the late Justice Scalia and what your take is in terms of how much influence you're seeing from Neil Gorsuch on Justice Kennedy in particular, and on the court in general so far.
Well, it'll be interesting to watch that dynamic because when Justice Gorsuch himself was a law clerk at the Supreme Court, he spent much of his time working for Justice Kennedy. He was originally hired by the late Justice Byron White, but spent much of his time sort of seconded to Justice Kennedy. And it's the first time that a law clerk has wound up serving on the court with his or her former boss. But Justice Scalia, as I think you started to get to, his views did not always break down neatly on the left-right spectrum, especially in some of the criminal justice issues that the court is going to be hearing this term. It will be very interesting to see how Justice Gorsuch compares to his predecessor on some of those issues.
Let's dive into some of the big cases that are before the court this term. Melissa wrote on our Facebook page, "At this point, it seems like making maps for voting districts without gerrymandering should be a high school project. They've got the skills, but aren't as politically indoctrinated." That brings us to the first big case we wanted to talk about, Gill versus Whitford. Professor Creighton, can you break down the case for us and what's at stake?
Sure, I'll try to do that briefly. So the state of Wisconsin was one among many states after 2010 that redrew district lines, and in doing so, the Republican Party did a very good job of planning a method of basically shifting a lot of the sort of center of gravity politically in the way that the districts were drawn to favor their party. And they did it using very sophisticated methods. After 2010, they happened to get the majority under the old plan. They used that majority to basically craft districts that really favored their side. Some would say, and I think the plaintiffs are among them, that it went beyond what is sort of constitutionally permitted. I'll get to that in a moment. But suffice to say that with about 48% of the vote, after they redrew the lines, they were able to get about 60% of the seats. And that was sort of repeated in different ways across the country. The plaintiffs in this case are arguing that that exceeded what the Constitution permits, and it invites the court to return to an area that they have mined a considerable amount, but fail to really offer a very clear standard to guide when a political party has gone too far. They've done it using, traditionally, this idea of equal protection, but going back to our friend Justice Kennedy has been the one person that has said that there should be space for the courts to intervene, notwithstanding some concerns about being too politicized. But he hasn't been as very clear about what the governing standard ought to be. And so the prior case out of Pennsylvania, Vieth, allowed Justice Kennedy to say to plaintiffs, come up with a standard that I like and I'll, you know, endorse it.
I do want to get to Professor Blackmun in a moment, but I just want to be clear. When you talk about the vote result being 48% and lawmakers coming up with about 60% of the seats, you're basically saying they didn't win a majority in the election, but they ended up with a majority in the legislature.
Indeed, an overwhelming majority. And I think the question is whether 60% of seats versus 48% of the ballots cast is so great a margin that you have to have some court intervention to cut that back.
Professor Blackmun, what is the legal question that's making this so sticky for the Supreme Court? Why hasn't this question been answered yet?
So decades ago, Justice Felix Frankfurter referred to districting as a thicket that courts should not get involved with, that historically this was a prerogative of the local legislature. Now, the courts have gotten involved when we have a racial gerrymander, that is, you draw a district to suppress the votes of African Americans or Latinos, but where the district is drawn to suppress the votes of Republicans or Democrats, it truly cuts both ways. The justices have simply stayed on the outside. What's new here is there's math, right? There's this theory, the efficiency gap, that says if your district is too safe, then we can actually calculate how many people should be shifted to another district so that your vote's competitive. You know, in some districts, when you vote, your vote's wasted. There's no chance that your candidate of choice will win. So now there's this formula that says we can figure out with some certainty how we should draw districts to minimize wasted votes.
We are discussing the Supreme Court's new term with Elizabeth Weidra, the president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, Josh Blackmun, constitutional law professor at South Texas College of Law in Houston, Kareem Creighton, a visiting professor at Vanderbilt Law School, and William Jay, partner and co-chair at the Goodwin Law Firm's Appellate Litigation Practice. Our conversation continues, but for many of you, your local NPR member station will be bringing you coverage of President Trump speaking after the Las Vegas shooting. This is 1A. Elizabeth Weidra, how do you see this case on gerrymandering? What do you think is going to hinge on?
I think when you look back to the way that the drafters of our Constitution thought about representation, it was that the voters should choose their representatives. The representatives shouldn't choose their voters. And I think the way that Professor Creighton laid out the problem of where you have such an incredible gap between what the majority of voters have cast their ballots for, and then the overwhelming majority going the other way in the state legislature, it's just remarkable. You know, we embrace our fundamental value of democracy. We are proud of our constitutional democracy. And I think when you look at that those numbers, it's really shocking. And, you know, as Professor Blackmun said, you know, there's this new math that the plaintiffs are putting before the court, basically Justice Kennedy. And so I think it's probably the best shot that there has been in a long time in getting the Supreme Court to step in here.
William J., I wonder how you view this, considering that, you know, as Elizabeth says, there is, for many people, this fundamental feeling of unfairness about gerrymandering. I mean, when we launched this show back in January, we asked people, what topics would you like us to talk about? Number one topic, I am not kidding, gerrymandering, for months until we actually did the show. But then the law also does give us a lot of leeway to draw our political districts as we see fit and to define fairness however we want to under the law. So I see both sides of this. What do you think it's going to come down to? If one side wins this one, what are they going to have to do to win?
I think they're going to have to convince the court that whether the current system is good or bad, and it has very few defenders in terms of the fairness of individual outcomes in one-party states, whether it be Maryland on the Democratic side or Wisconsin on the Republican side, whether the outcomes are good or bad, that it would be worse for the courts to get involved in scrutinizing districting plans and deciding for themselves what is fair. That's what I think the defenders of the current state of the law are going to have to convince a majority of the court to stick with, that it would be worse to have the courts get involved in superintending districting every 10 years and have, you know, tens or dozens of these cases go up to the Supreme Court every 10 years than to stick with the current system, which at least has political accountability as a backstop.
Professor Creighton, what do you make of the history of the court dealing with gerrymandering in terms of the clarity with which it deals with racial gerrymandering, but the opacity with which it deals with the rest? I mean, I'm not a legal scholar, but it kind of seems to me if you're monkeying around with the political lines for any reason, it has the potential to cross over into race, class, gender, orientation, religion, you know, socioeconomic status, any number of things. But again, I also see the other side of it. Like, I see both. What do you make of that? Where race is the clear one, but everything else is kind of fuzzy.
So I'm going to take issue with the observation that race is the clear one.
Okay.
Unfortunately, that too is a rather conflated and confusing area of the law where the court has been involved. And in fact, the first observation is to point out that in the absence of a clear standard with partisan gerrymandering, many of the same actors who dispute whether there should or shouldn't be a standard in that realm have used racial gerrymandering as a place to kind of prosecute their claims. And so often the doctrine of racial gerrymandering has gotten confused in part because people are trying to work with a reality that the political parties have a stake in whether or not districts are drawn in a way that is favorable or not to non-white groups. The other point about this, though, is it is also, and I don't disagree with William's point about court intervention, it's certainly going to be one of the considerations, but it is also important to recognize that courts have political effects even when they choose not to act. And often the question, not just in gerrymandering, but any number of election law cases is, if you are going to have a political effect, what is the effect going to be? As opposed to whether or not you're going to have a political effect at all by choosing to intervene. I think we've opened the door to this probably at the point where we talked about Justice Frankfurter warning about the political thicket. And so now that we're in it, I think the hard question, and maybe Justice Kennedy has gotten to that point, what standard ought we use to guide ourselves in trying to work through the problem?
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Let's continue with another case that Rob tweeted us about. Rob wrote, "Even as an evangelical Christian, my feelings are mixed about the bake shop case. It's not a religious nonprofit, so I don't think religious freedom applies." Elizabeth Wydra, he's talking about Masterpiece Cake Shop Limited versus Colorado Rights Commission. I understand you filed an amicus brief in this case and several others on the Supreme Court docket. So give us your perspective on what's going on in this case.
Yes, we plan to file an amicus brief in that case, and we have, for example, in the Gill case, filed on behalf of a bipartisan group of representatives showing that the issue crosses ideological lines. The Masterpiece Cake Shop case is a really important case this term that has been billed by, you know, a lot of the stories about the Supreme Court term as pitting religious liberty and free expression against the rights of same-sex couples. The facts of the case involve a couple who wanted to get a cake from this particular cake shop handmade by the baker for their wedding. There are a couple of gay men who are enjoying their constitutional right to marriage equality as decreed by the Supreme Court. And the baker said that he could not make this cake because of his religious beliefs, which apparently are that he does not believe in same-sex marriage. The Colorado state discrimination law says that you cannot do this. And so he is challenging that all the way up to the Supreme Court. There's been this hybrid argument put forward that kind of meshes the idea of free speech and free expression with religious liberty. But, you know, from my perspective, we've dealt with this. We had cases back several decades ago about racial discrimination in public accommodations. And the Supreme Court said that when you are in the commercial market space, when you are, as your commenter said, a non-religious organization, you're just a business in the public square, you have to not discriminate against people based on race or creed or color or orientation.
The cake baker, Jack Phillips, talked about this case on the ABC series The View back in June of this year. Here is a piece of what he said.
The Supreme Court is willing to hear it. That tells you something, that there's more to it than I discriminated against a couple. Mm-hmm. What I did was not to discriminate, not to judge, but to decline to make a cake, an artistic creation, for an event. These two gentlemen are welcome in my store today. They're welcome in my store every day. I welcome everybody who comes in. I don't make every cake for every event.
That was the cake baker, Jack Phillips, speaking on The View. We're up against a break in a moment, but William J., I wonder if maybe that's the piece this hinges on. It's not that Mr. Phillips said you can't buy any cake. The question is, do I have to make you a new cake, create one bespoke for your ceremony? But if he's discriminating, if the law says they have a right to all the benefits of marriage, wouldn't that include a cake?
Well, you know, the one analogy that I've seen is, you know, imagine that you're an artist and you have a storefront, and President Trump comes in one day and says, I've decided I want to buy my official portrait from you. And the artist says, I don't want to use my artistic talents to paint your official portrait, Mr. President. And Mr. Phillips is basically saying, I work in fondant and icing, not with paint and brush, but I do the same thing.
I could hear the teeth of a lot of artists grit shut as soon as you made that example. But it's a good one, and I want to keep talking about it when we continue. I should also let you know we are, of course, continuing to follow the latest in the investigation after the shooting on the Las Vegas Strip. The police in Mesquite, Nevada, where the shooter, Stephen Paddock, lived, are just now giving a briefing to the nation. We'll follow that and give you any developments as best we can. We are awaiting President Trump speaking to the nation about the shooting in Las Vegas. And of course, we welcome more of your questions and thoughts about the Supreme Court's docket for the fall term. We'll get to all that in a moment. Stay close. Before we continue our conversation, I should note that officials in Las Vegas do have a number for any of you listening coast to coast who are trying to get in touch with your loved ones who may have been at the scene of the Route 91 festival and who may have been caught up in the shooting there. Here is the number to call for information about loved ones. 866-535-5654. Again, that's specifically for family reunification pursuant to the Las Vegas Strip shooting. 866-535-5654. Back now to our conversation about the Supreme Court's fall term with Elizabeth Wydra of the Constitutional Accountability Center, Professor Josh Blackman of South Texas College of Law in Houston, Professor Kareem Creighton of Vanderbilt Law School, and William Jay of the Goodwin Law Firm's Appellate Litigation Practice. Still time to get in some more of your questions and thoughts about what the High Court might be dealing with this fall. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Professor Blackman, the Department of Justice, with regards to this cake baker case, the Department of Justice filed a brief on behalf of the cake baker, Jack Phillips. What do you make of that? Is that unusual?
Well, what you have to keep in mind is that this is not actually a free exercise case. It's a free speech case. And the government's brief was actually on the side of the First Amendment. And to use a very contemporary example, the question is, can the government make you engage in speech? An example is used before about making a portrait of Donald Trump. I'll give you another example. Can someone make you stand for the Pledge of Allegiance or the national anthem? And there's a fairly long-standing string of cases in this country saying that, no, the government can't make you salute the flag. They cannot make you stand for the national anthem. And if you want to take a knee, that's your constitutional right to do so. So the position taken by the Justice Department has nothing to do with free exercise. It's entirely about the fact that the government can't make you engage in an act of speech that you do not want to engage. And the First Amendment trumps any discrimination law in this regard, whether you're a corporation or otherwise, because you have the right as an artist not to engage in this speech act.
Well, but then let me ask you this. If I had gone to Mr. Phillips with my partner and I said, we are getting married. Here is a picture of the cake I want you to make. Build this cake. Is that still covered by what you're referring to? If there's no artistic expression involved, if I say, copy this image, is that the same principle?
Oh, I disagree. There is artistic expression involved. How much flour to add, how much water to add, the sort of food coloring you add, the way you do your fondant. This is an artistic act.
If I brought you all the ingredients, use these ingredients, use these colors, right. Build this cake. I don't have the skill. Just provide the service.
Well, the act of actually making the cake is an act of artistry. The act of blending the ingredients, the act of mixing it, the act of designing in a certain way. We have a fairly long tradition in this country, and this court has recognized it, that when it comes to speaking, to make someone speak, even if you're telling them exactly how to do it, is problematic. For example, if I give you a license plate that says live free or die, that's the exact license plate to use. I'm not giving you any options. You do not have to display the message live free or die because your free speech rights protect against that.
Well, unless I want to drive in that state, then I do have to display that license plate, don't I?
But you can cover it. No, you can cover it, and that's the Supreme Court's decision. That's when I put a piece of tape over the message, live free or die, because they didn't want to express that message.
Oh, I got you. Covered that part of the life. Gotcha.
Exactly.
Yeah. I know Elizabeth wants to jump back in. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's, you know, probably the best argument that could be made on behalf of discriminating against gay couples and the provision of your services. But, you know, we have a long tradition also in this country of ensuring that businesses treat customers equally. And, you know, we had a case in the context of the 1964 Civil Rights Act that prohibited racial discrimination in public accommodations like restaurants, hotels, etc. And in that case, we were talking about a barbecue chain. Now, I think a lot of people, especially barbecue lovers, would say that the putting together of a barbecue sauce is like an art form in and of itself, like the cake. And the court said, no, you know, this is about the human dignity of the customers coming in to be treated as equal citizens and not be denied services on the basis of their race or, in this case, their sexual orientation.
I want to keep going. I know there's a lot more that we could discuss with this, but I want to make sure that we touch on a few more of the big cases that are coming up this term, particularly as it related to President Trump's travel ban. The Supreme Court was set to hear oral arguments over the travel ban that was taken off the table after the travel restrictions were revised and expanded. They now include Venezuela, North Korea, and Chad. Professor Kareem Creighton, what do you see now as the path forward for this matter over the travel ban?
Well, procedurally, the Supreme Court has asked the parties to review their positions based on the position now that the Trump administration has offered, and presumably either they will remand perhaps to the lower courts to consider it, but I think it's quite likely that this will be brought forward. I think some of the same issues exist, in my opinion, that would challenge the question as to whether or not the president is being overly selective in adopting the ban, but I suspect this question will eventually make it back to the court. But one of the powers of this court, of course, is to time when it decides to address a case, and I suspect that's going to be one of the powers that it exercises here.
William J., as I understand it, there are some other immigration cases that will be reheard this term because the court was evenly split on them during the vacancy after the passing of Antonin Scalia before Neil Gorsuch was confirmed. It just speaks to the power of every single justice on the Supreme Court. Can you briefly tell us what's at stake in some of these other cases?
Sure. One of them has to do with when immigrants are being detained pending their removal from the country and, you know, being sent back to whatever country has been designated as their destination. After a certain point, do they have a right to a bond hearing? Or can they remain in detention for, you know, a long period of time? And the other has to do with, it's basically both a criminal issue and an immigration issue. It has to do with whether the definition of what crimes qualify as a basis for removal is impermissibly vague. So these are cases that could potentially affect a large number of people. They don't directly turn on the kind of issues that we've been talking about in the context of the travel ban, but because immigration has been such a hot-button issue, and because the new justice is obviously going to be right at the center of these two new cases, they're getting a lot of attention.
Professor Blackman, let's shift gears to a privacy case involving government access to cell phone records. The case is Carpenter versus United States. What's going on in this case? What's at stake?
So when the government wants to listen to your phone calls, they need a warrant. If they want to read your text messages, they need a warrant. But what happens when they want data from your cell phone company about where you've been? We all have GPSs in our smartphones, which basically track step by step where we're going by reference to GPS and the closest cell phone tower. In this case, the government obtained this location data, what's called the metadata, without a search warrant. And Mr. Carpenter has challenged the collection of this data, saying it was unconstitutional in violation of the Fourth Amendment, and it requires a warrant. So this is perhaps one of the most momentous cases of the year, because one of the ways that the government now obtains evidence is not by listening to our calls, but by tracking where we're going. And if we're in the vicinity of a crime, that can be used to convict us. The justices have not ruled on this issue yet. There's some old cases from the 1970s which say any information that you make public, whether to your bank or to the phone company, is public and it's out of your hands. So what the government argues here is by keeping your GPS on and using a cell phone, you are disclosing to the cell phone company where you've been, and too bad. Carpenter says, no, 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 this is protected by the Fourth Amendment and you need a warrant.
Elizabeth, I wonder if we have any sense of what some of the court's thought process might be on this. I mean, your GPS data and all the many forms of data that are, you know, that your phone is sending out all the time, it's not exactly, it's kind of a very passive form of data release. You don't necessarily exert granular control over every single app that has your location, even though you could. How do you expect the court to think this through?
Right, exactly. And, you know, I think even beyond the cell phone location towers, the court will be thinking ahead, as it often does when grappling with these new issues of constitutional protections, to facial recognition. You know, we think of all those video cameras that keep tabs on us, you know, as we go throughout our daily lives. But the court has been fairly and perhaps surprisingly robust and in accord on protecting privacy rights in the digital age. The one of the cases that Professor Blackman mentioned gave protections under the Fourth Amendment to cell phone searches. And that was something that hadn't actually been addressed before. And so the Supreme Court a few years ago in the Riley case came to the unanimous conclusion that the Fourth Amendment does require that under most circumstances you get a warrant in order to look at information on your cell phone. So I think that, you know, given that we had both the left and the right come together on the court in that earlier case, it's going to be interesting to watch this case to see whether or not you have that same unanimity in protection of privacy rights.
Professor Creighton, are the courts being called in this case to do the kind of legal interpretation that Congress should be doing? I mean, I know that the courts would prefer that Congress handle making laws. And it seems like digital privacy, dealing with information, is the sort of thing that there ought to be a law about. I wonder how much, and you would know better than me, but I wonder how much the courts are kind of scraping up against this bleeding edge, especially as it relates to technology, to interpret the law when it really should be Congress's job.
That's a really fair point, and I'd like to highlight this as one of the areas that the absence of Justice Scalia probably will have its greatest effect. We don't quite know where Gorsuch is going to land, but I think it's fair to say that there definitely are views on the court that would suggest that this is an area where Congress should legislate to give some guidance as to sort of what the scope of privacy laws ought to be, and then allow the court to then review in accordance with what it understands the privacy protections in the Constitution say. Here, though, I think what's going to happen is you're going to at least see a push by some on the court to say, well, in the absence of legislative action, we need to give these plaintiffs an answer and, frankly, some guidance to not just the Congress, but, frankly, state governments in terms of giving some direction for law enforcement about what they can and can't do. And a large part of it will depend upon, I think as has been said earlier, how the courts understand technology and its role in privacy. And, of course, sitting in the background, I just have to say, is, of course, all of these questions about email and right. Twitter and all the things that we deal with in the political sphere as well.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Actually, Professor Creighton, let me stick with you for just a minute, because there are a series of voting rights cases that are heading to the court, particularly focused on the voter rolls and how voters are purged from those rolls. Can you explain what's going on there?
Sure. There's a case out of Ohio, Husted versus the A. Philip Randolph Institute, that raises a question about what the state can do when it engages in the administrative management of our voter rolls. There are two federal laws that have been on the books for a while, the Help America Vote Act and the National Voter Registration Act, that imposes on states an obligation to do certain things to maintain voter rolls for those who want to register and are eligible. State of Ohio engaged in the process of creating a system whereby it assured from its perspective that there wasn't fraud. And one of the ways in which they did it, according to them, was to establish a process whereby a person who chooses not to vote gets a notice indicating that we've noticed you've not voted. If you choose not to vote in the next two elections, essentially, you're going to be taken off the voter rolls. And the plaintiffs, the A. Philip Randolph Institute, suggested that this was inconsistent with federal law that allows you to be entitled to vote whether or not you choose to vote in a given election or not. And the implications are significant. There are about 40,000 votes, for example, in Cuyahoga County, the biggest county in the state, that might be implicated by this. The appellate court in the Sixth Circuit overturned a decision to dismiss this claim. So now it's presented to the United States Supreme Court to determine whether or not the laws have been consistently applied and practiced by the Secretary of State.
I wonder if before we end the hour, we can talk a little bit more about the composition of the court. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg spoke about Justice Gorsuch taking his seat on the court in that address she gave to law students last month at Georgetown Law Center. Here's a little more of what she said.
For 14 months, we were only 8 on the bench. Neil Gorsuch became the 113th justice in time to join us for our last sitting in April. He had only 1 week between his confirmation and the start of the sitting, but he managed to prepare well for 13 cases. He also cast himself as a potential rival to Justice Sotomayor as the justice who asked the most questions at oral argument.
That was Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg speaking last month at Georgetown. Professor Blackmun, before we run out of time, I wonder what you think in terms of the future of the members of the U.S. Supreme Court. There's talk about when Ruth Bader Ginsburg will want to retire. Justice Anthony Kennedy might be looking to retire. That would open up a seat for the president to make another nomination. If you had to bet, if you had to guess, what do you think the court's going to look like a year or two from now?
Well, the first wrinkle is, does Justice Gorsuch simply fill Justice Scalia's seat, or does he go beyond that? As Willie mentioned earlier, Gorsuch clerked for Kennedy some years ago. So I think it's entirely possible that Justice Gorsuch may be able to pull Justice Kennedy to the right a little bit in ways Justice Scalia couldn't. I don't buy the Jeffrey Toobin thesis that he's annoying his colleagues. I think Jeffrey Toobin annoys the justices far more than Neil Gorsuch ever will. But beyond that, I think we have to look for Justice Kennedy's retirement, right? There were rumors he would retire last year. He didn't. He's getting up in age, as is Justice Breyer and Justice Ginsburg. They're both over 80 at this point. So even if perhaps Justice Kennedy holds on for another year or two, if President Trump serves a full 8 years, which I think is possible, you may see a very, very different court. And so long as the Congress or the Senate is held by Republicans, there's very little Democrats can do to stop it. Now, the magic question is, what happens if President Trump's in office and the Democrats control the Senate? I think we're going to see some payback, and I think we can actually see a seat empty for a year or two or longer to wait till the next presidential election. So 8 may become the new 9 if that happens.
That is Professor Josh Blackmun of the South Texas College of Law in Houston. Professor, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
William Jay, partner and co-chair of Goodwin Law Firm's appellate litigation practice and former clerk to the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. William, thank you.
Thank you.
Professor Kareem Creighton of Vanderbilt Law School and a managing partner at Crimcard Consulting Services. Thank you, Professor Creighton.
Thank you so much.
And Elizabeth Wydra, president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a public interest law firm and think tank here in Washington. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me.
I should note that President Trump just made remarks to the nation following the shooting in Las Vegas. He says that flags will fly at half staff in memory of the tragedy. The president referred to this as an act of pure evil and called the police response miraculous. Among other things, the president said, quote, "We pray for the day when evil is banished and the innocent are safe from hatred and fear." The president said to have found the shooter so quickly after the first shots were fired is something of which we will always be thankful, unquote. And the president says he will make a visit to Las Vegas on Wednesday. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.